Marshall, will you call the next case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Larkin, and Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Jessen presiding. Before the court is case A20-0239, Kate Ayes v. Megan Hamilton.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second of six matters on our calendar for today, three of which are oral arguments via Zoom.gov. The basic same rules apply here as they do in our physical courtrooms. Each side will have 15 minutes for argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You'll see there is a timer in one screen to help us all keep track of that time. And I'd also finally remind you to please introduce yourself for our recording when you begin your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Marshall Tanick. I represent the appellant, Megan Hamilton, in this proceeding. Ms. Hamilton owns and operates a nonprofit organization known as Basil's Cradle. It provides expert care for our domestic and special needs cats, and it provides a lifetime sanctuary for cats who have physical afflictions and other needs. There are two issues before the court this morning. One is the ownership of a 10-year-old cat named Oliver. A second issue is a claim of defamation by the appellant, Hamilton, against the respondent, Katie Ossie. The lower court, the trial court, entered summary judgment on both issues. The lower court ruled that Ms. Hamilton, who had possession and ownership of the cat at the time, was not entitled to the cat and had to return her to Ossie, who originally had the cat. And the trial court also dismissed the defamation claims as well, entering summary judgment. The legal standard for review is different in those two issues. As to the issue of the ownership of the cat, we maintain that there are significant, genuine, material fact issues that preclude summary judgment. So as to the defamation issue, we maintain that the court erred as a matter of law in determining that none of the alleged defamatory statements were actionable. So those are the two different legal standards. As set forth in our brief, the cat, a 10-year-old cat, was a seriously ill cat. It had diabetes. The original owner of the cat was respondent Katie Ossie. She couldn't take care of and handle the cat. And in fact, at one point said that because of her finances and lack of ability to care for the cat, she was going to euthanize the cat. She didn't do that, fortunately, and brought it to an organization, or she was referred by a rescue organization to Ms. Hamilton, who, as I indicated, is rather well known in the cat community for taking care of sick and ailing cats.
Mr. Tanick?
Yes.
Oh. Actually, Judge Larkin, feel free to go ahead.
Thank you. The first issue, ownership, there's a lot of talk about, was it a surrender or not? But there's not really a lot of information about, you know, the word surrender. Does it have legal meaning? Does that establish ownership? As I understand the case, the ownership issue seems to come down to whether there was an oral contract between these folks. And if so, was there a meeting of the mind? And if so, what was the agreement? Am I correct to view the issues that way? Or is there some other analytical framework for how we approach the ownership issue?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the ownership issue can be viewed as a matter of law. The communications between the parties established the relationship. So in a sense, there was a contractual relationship, but we maintain that the words used by the parties as construed in normal, ordinary understanding would give rise to a transfer of ownership as
okay,
a matter
but still
of law.
Still in all, at the end of the day, we need some sort of analytical framework to say, was there a transfer of ownership? And it seems to me that framework we would use is oral contract. Do you agree?
I mean, there's right. No. Yes, sure. Yes, I agree that there was an oral agreement between the parties.
Okay.
It wasn't documented. And I might note that while sometimes transfer of pets is documented, it doesn't have to be as a matter
it's
of law.
It's not a statute of frauds issue.
Right. And so
okay.
This was an oral arrangement. And the trial court we maintain erred as a matter of summary judgment by construing, plaintiff brought the motion, Ossie brought the motion for summary judgment, and we maintain there are disputed facts, at a minimum, there are disputed facts as to what the agreement was. We maintain that the agreement is provided for Hamilton to have possession and ownership and control of the cat. But at a minimum, there's a disputed factual issue that precludes summary judgment. The language used by the parties is significant. Ossie said that she gave, quote, verbal permission and, quote, verbally surrendered him. She went on, and this is one of the transcripts, both parties transcribed their calls. Ossie further said, I don't have a lot of ground to stand on here. I should have been clear. I formally surrendered the cat. It was my mistake. And then she asked, she'd like to see him one last time. Well, I think as a matter of general understanding, without getting into even dictionary definitions of what surrender means, that that language is very evocative and strongly suggests, in fact, establishes that Ms. Ossie gave the cat to Ms. Hamilton, transferred ownership.
Mr. Tanik, you're not asking us to grant you summary judgment. You're just asking us to reverse the district court and send it back for trial, right?
Your Honor, the trial court did enter summary judgment. We're asking to reverse that, but we also note that this court can determine that as a matter of law, and there is case law where the courts have determined that summary judgment is not only inappropriate for the moving party, but based on the record, summary judgment should be granted for the non-moving party. And there is case law that we cited to that effect. So we think
Mr. Tanik, wouldn't it be inconsistent to accept your argument that the district court erred in granting summary judgment on the issue of ownership because there are genuine issues of material fact, and then turn around and say your client's entitled to summary judgment? I mean, if these issues need to be sorted out before a jury in terms of what the facts are, then why would we grant your client summary judgment?
Well, I don't think they're not necessarily inconsistent. They're in the alternative. We maintain that the record reflects here as a matter of fact in law that there was a transfer of ownership and we should be entitled to summary judgment. However, we recognize in the alternative, at a minimum, there are fact disputes. If the court determines, no, there's not enough evidence to support our position that we should be entitled to summary judgment, and we maintain we are, but if the court determines as an alternative to that, there's at a minimum, at least, material facts in dispute that preclude summary judgment. And the language, as I indicated here, was so evocative by Ms. Ossie using the word surrender and verbal permission, not having a leg to ground to stand on. She made a mistake, she said. She wanted to see the cat one last time. That should give rise to summary judgment on our behalf, but at a minimum in the alternative.
That, I'm sure we'll hear this from respondents' attorney. We have your client saying, yes, I'll give you your cat back, and talking about setting up visitation. I mean, and there's another side to this dispute, which would suggest, well, it was perhaps temporary.
Well, there was conditions as part of that understanding or a verbal agreement, oral agreement, Your Honor, as you noted, Ms. Hamilton said that she would, quote, consider, and this is in the record, and this is the exact language used by the parties, exactly from the transcript, but fortunate in a sense to have them both having recorded the conversations. Ms. Hamilton said that she would, quote, consider returning the cat to Ms. Ossie if the cat went into remission from the diabetes, and if in her own discretion, Ms. Hamilton thought that Ms. Ossie could take care and handle the cat, because initially the cat came to Ms. Hamilton because Ossie was threatening to euthanize the cat. So there was conditions attached in that sense. Ms. Hamilton did clearly say, and it's in the record, I will consider returning the cat to you if the cat goes into remission, and I think you can handle it. Neither of those occurred. The cat, as of the time of the trial proceeding, lower court proceedings, was not in remission. In fact, the cat had been doing a little bit better, but the cat was still ill and needed that kind of veterinary care and other care that provided through Ms. Hamilton. So the understanding and agreement was that Ms. Ossie did transfer ownership, control, custody, total complete dominion of the cat to Hamilton. There was some talk about visiting the cat, and she said she'd like to see him one last time. And Hamilton and Ossie did agree that Hamilton would consider returning the cat after the, if the cat was in remission and she thought she could handle it, but neither of those occurred. So the record here reflects a transfer of ownership.
Mr. Kanick, let's turn to your defamation claims.
Yes.
So if we agree with you with regard to there are disputed facts on whether or not there was a total surrender or giving of this cat to your client, then you've alleged that there are these actionable defamatory statements. And one of them is whether or not your client stole the cat. It seems to me that would turn on who owns the cat, first of all. And so if you could address that. And then secondly, the other, tell me how the district court judge got it wrong when she determined that the other statements were matter of opinion.
Sure. As to the Aussie posted on various social media, Yelp, Google, and Facebook, these various statements. So they were fairly widespread. One statement was that Hamilton had, quote, stolen my cat. Now, that's an allegation of a crime. It's defamatory per se, slander, libel per se. If the cat, in order to make, if the cat, even if the trial court was correct, and we maintain it was not, that there had been some error in the transfer of the cat and Aussie should have the cat back, which we maintain is wrong, that doesn't necessarily equate with stealing. Ms. Hamilton, at a minimum, had a claim of right to the cat, and the fact that the cat was in dispute between the two does not constitute stealing a cat. So that's that statement that she committed a crime is not borne out by the record here at all, even if you look at it most generously from the standpoint of the respondent. At best, there was a misunderstanding. The cat should go back to Aussie, which we maintain was wrong, but that does not equate with stealing as a matter of law. It's not a theft by Hamilton, even under the respondent's position here, firstly. Secondly, as to the other statements, Your Honor, the defamatory statements, one of them was that Ms. Hamilton, quote, cannot be trusted. That's defamatory as a matter of law. Accusations of dishonesty or lack of trustworthiness are deemed to be actionable defamation in a number of cases. The Wiseman versus Sri Lanka Curry case said that you calling someone dishonest was actionable. Anderson v. Kmaier, which is a 1977 Supreme Court case, is right on point. The offensive language in the Anderson versus Kmaier case, the Supreme Court case, is that the claimant, quote, should not be trusted, should not be trusted. The Supreme Court held that those words, that someone should not be trusted, constitutes actionable defamation. In this case, the wording was almost identical. Anderson versus Kmaier should not be trusted. In this case, it cannot be trusted. So questioning someone's trustworthiness or honesty is, as a matter of law, actionable defamation. Of course, the jury ultimately has to determine if it was defamatory, but as a matter of law, that gets submitted to the jury. There's another case decided by the Eighth Circuit this summer. It's a federal case, but I think it's illustrative. It's Turrentine versus Peterson. It's cited in our reply brief. There again, there was an accusation of dishonesty in the Eighth Circuit, applying general common law, held that accusations of dishonesty or being untrustworthy or words to that effect are actionable defamation, subject to the jury determining as a matter of fact whether defamation occurred or not. The other accusations and the other defamatory allegations in this case include that Hamilton did not carry out her work in a, quote, professional manner. It's common law defamation states that if you accuse someone of not being a professional or acting in a professional manner, that can be actionable. Again, that's a jury question, but questioning someone's compliance or conformance with professional standards can constitute actionable defamation. The fourth defamatory accusation here is that people should not patronize Ms. Hamilton or do business with her or the veterinarian with whom she is associated with. Again, and interfering with someone's business operations and telling people not to patronize a business because the business owner cannot be trusted and has committed a crime of theft, stealing, is actionable as a matter of law, again, subject to a jury determination. So we maintain, Your Honor, that none of those statements fall within the opinion defense in the context of this case or in the context of any other case, in particular, the accusation of stealing a cat, which is not borne out by the record here, and the fact that the accusation that someone cannot be trusted under well-established case law. So we maintain, Your Honor, that based on the record here, the court can, and there is authority, to not only reverse summary judgment, but grant summary judgment on the ownership issue to Hamilton and order the cat to be returned to her. In post-hearing proceedings in the lower court, the cat was required to be given back to Ossie. We maintain that summary judgment for Hamilton's appropriate and the return of the cat to her. Or, as I said to Judge Warnke, at a minimum, there's factual disputes that preclude summary judgment, warranting a trial, as well as on the defamation claims asserted in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll turn to counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Brian Lenorth appearing on behalf of respondent Katie Ossie. While this case admittedly does not rise to the level of high stakes complexity over which this court normally presides, the resolution of this case is nonetheless important to the parties involved. I'm happy to report that Oliver is doing well under Ms. Ossie's care. As counsel for Ms. Hamilton provides, there are two core issues before this court. The first is whether Ms. Hamilton, the facts that Ms. Hamilton argues are in dispute pertaining to Oliver's ownership are material so as to make the district court summary judgment decision improper. The second is whether Ms. Hamilton has any actual defamation counterclaims.
So, counsel, could we just start there? I know you'll want to talk about ownership, but since Mr. Tanik was talking about the defamation most recently, even if we agreed with you and affirmed summary judgment on the ownership question, why wouldn't this statement that Hamilton cannot be trusted be defamation by implication, or at least enough to, at this point, go to the jury? I mean, I think that is just the phrase that worries me the most.
Sure. So on that statement, the McKee decision cited in our brief stands for the proposition that so long as the substance, the gist, the sting of the charge is justified, Ms. Hamilton doesn't have a valid claim for defamation. Here, of course, truth is a defense. Ms. Hamilton does not dispute that she refused to return Oliver, and the district courts concluded that Ms. Ossie was the rightful owner. Those two facts alone are sufficient for the substance, the sting, the gist of the charge to be justified.
But counsel, doesn't that argument presume that the district court correctly granted summary judgment? I mean, if this court were to conclude there is a genuine issue of material fact regarding ownership, doesn't that implicate both the statements that she stole the cat and she can't be trusted? I mean, they seem to address the same set of circumstances. That is, she refused to give the cat back.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. I do see those issues as correlated. So if one fails, the other fails. But if one is affirmed, the other should be affirmed as well.
Counsel, could you tell me, I read this record, the summary judgment record that was before the district court, which is what I'm going to limit my consideration to. And it seems to be a situation where we have to decide whether there was an oral agreement. And if so, what were the terms? One side says, she gave me the cat, it was mine to keep. Only if I decided to give it back, would it go back? The other says, no, I gave her the cat temporarily to provide care. It was supposed to come back to me. And each side presents evidence that could reasonably support their position and that could reasonably refute the other side's position. I'm not seeing one piece of evidence in the summary judgment record that is, shall we say, the smoking gun. I mean, one piece of evidence that is so strong that reasonable people could not view it differently. Can you tell me what is the best evidence in the summary judgment record that supports the district court's award of summary judgment. It's determination that it's not necessary to let a jury hear both sides and decide where the truth is.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree with you that this is essentially a determination of whether or not there was an oral agreement in a meeting of the minds. Our position is there wasn't. Ms. Hamilton's position is that there was an oral agreement. You asked, or you remarked, you're not seeing any smoking guns, and I agree that there is none on Ms. Hamilton's side. But here, for Ms. Ozzie, there are two pieces of evidence that no reasonable jury could conclude otherwise. The first is Ms. Hamilton's argument in her opening brief that she could not have cared for Oliver or brought him to a vet unless Oliver was, she was Oliver's owner or Ms. Ozzie's employee. But Ms. Hamilton, in the days following the supposed agreement, requested Ms. Ozzie call the vet and list Ms. Ozzie as her agent for Oliver's care. The second smoking gun is months later, in a recorded transcript, Ms. Hamilton, after numerous times referring to Oliver as Ms. Ozzie's cat, laughs off a question by Ms. Ozzie whether the goal was still to return Oliver, saying, yes, I'm giving your cat back. That is found on page 37 okay. of respondent's addendum.
As to the statement about authorize me to act as your agent, was that conversation, did it occur after Ms. Hamilton had taken the cat into her home or before that time?
After.
Okay.
Opposing counsel will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was right in approximately 1 week after Ms. Hamilton took possession. That completely undermines her position that she was the owner.
But it certainly impacts the determination of her credibility. But does it necessarily establish with certainty the nature of the transaction between these two women?
To me, it does, Your Honor, because Ms. Hamilton, in her own argument, says the veterinarian could not have cared for Oliver unless she was the owner or Ms. Ozzie's employee. If she was either, that request for agency would not have been necessary. Your Honor, shifting to the cat ownership issue, you touch on an important concept, and that is the issue of materiality, which this court said in American Bank of St. Paul, that a genuine issue of material fact exists if the evidence would permit reasonable persons to draw different conclusions. Ms. Hamilton's sole case relies upon her self-serving affidavit and the use of the word surrender. That use of the word surrender is not disputed. In Risdale, this court provided that a self-serving affidavit contradicted by other testimony or evidence in the record does not create a genuine issue, of material fact.
But here there seems to be more than a self-serving affidavit, doesn't there? Because your client, in a recorded call, makes statements about, I know I don't have the leg to stand on, I surrendered the cat. The record indicates that this started because your client said, I don't want the cat anymore, I can't care for the cat, and also made statements about having a last visit with the cat. So I'm having a hard time viewing this as, well, this is just a self-serving affidavit. There seems to be some evidence on the other side that supports Ms. Hamilton's position that the agreement was that she was taking the cat permanently and that maybe someday she would give the cat back depending on its health.
Yeah, I disagree, Your Honor. Respectfully disagree. Ms. Ozzie doesn't dispute that she was distraught and not sure what to do with Oliver. She cares deeply about these pair of bonded cats that she adopted together. And she was faced with a very difficult decision that none of us would envy. Mr. Tanik says that Ms. Ozzie had plans to euthanize. That's not in the evidence. She worried that he might deteriorate to the point where euthanization was required. She was distraught, sought guidance, and approached Tanya Richter, who...
Counsel, let me ask you this. And because we're aware of the facts, so I just want to make the most of our time together this morning. Is my understanding correct? Your client paid for the first vet bill while the cat was in the custody of Ms. Hamilton. After that, Ms. Hamilton's organization paid for all the bills.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Couldn't a jury look at that and say, you know, why would Ms. Hamilton and her organization be paying all these expensive vet bills if it wasn't her cat?
Ms. Hamilton, Your Honor, didn't request for Ms. Ozzie to pay those. She made remarks about, the cost of paying for Ms. Ozzie's cat, and Ms. Ozzie offered to pay. That's what's in the record.
But so I'm just saying, in terms of a reasonable person, might a reasonable person look at this and say, well, no reasonable person is going to incur all these bills for a pet or a cat that's not their cat?
But Ms. Hamilton is not an ordinary person. She runs a cat rescue and sanctuary, and that is their mission, to care for cats. She creates this falsity that her organization cannot care for anyone else's cats, but that isn't a statute or any law. That's just something that she invented.
And I don't know where the truth is. I'm having a hard time understanding how the truth is so clear on this record that it shouldn't go to a jury.
Yeah. In Your Honor, this I put into the caliber of the district court's proper rule of reviewing the evidence, and they have a proper gatekeeping rule of whether or not evidence is material or relevant.
True enough, but the case law also instructs us that summary judgment is a blunt instrument. Its use should be, you know, restrained, and that if there is a doubt as to whether or not summary judgment is appropriate, you don't grant summary judgment. I mean, the win goes to the person opposing. And it seems to me that this case is, you know, on that line where, boy, it's really close. There's evidence on both sides.
Yeah, I'm aware of the recent jurisprudence that summary judgment shouldn't be granted as a matter of course. But I do see this as the quintessential case where the evidence shouldn't go to trial. This isn't the case where we should impanel a jury during the pandemic so they can speculate what really did Ms. Ozzie mean by the word surrender. This case,
well, you know, counsel, at the beginning you argued that this is an important case, it's important to the people, and I mean, now to argue, well, this doesn't warrant, you know, time and attention during a pandemic, that seems a little inconsistent. It's either important or it's not.
Yeah, it's important to the parties.
I don't know that importance is the gauge of, you know, making a summary judgment ruling.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I concede that point. Unless Your Honor has any more questions on that particular issue, I would like to shift into the defamation. We spoke briefly about sort of the correlation between the ownership of Oliver issue and the statement that Ms. Hamilton stole my cat. The statements that we didn't talk about are the other three alleged defamatory statements, which are on their face non-actual opinions. Those statements include statements to the fact that Ms. Hamilton cannot be trusted, does not act in a professional manner, and that people should not do business with her.
Counsel, wait, I thought we talked about at the beginning, you said that if we were reversing on summary judgment and saying, nope, this should go to the trial, the two defamation comments that went, you know, allegations that really went along with that were both she stole my cat and Hamilton cannot be trusted. Am I wrong about that?
I maybe misunderstood your question, Your Honor. I thought the question was limited to the statement that Ms. Hamilton stole my cat. I see that particular statement as being related to the summary judgment decision on the ownership of Oliver. The other three statements, that she does not conduct herself in a professional manner, cannot be trusted, and that people should avoid doing business, I see those as standalone.
Well, why isn't she can't be trusted really saying the same thing as she stole my cat? I mean, why, for purposes of whether it should go to the jury, why wouldn't they be pretty much the same? And especially, maybe you could address the case law Mr. Tanik referred us to as well.
Yeah, so there is a more recent decision by this court, and that's in the decision of Kapoor v. Brown from 2014, where this court rejected similar arguments to Ms. Hamilton the ones that Ms. Hamilton now raises, finding that a statement about a person's trustworthiness to be a non-actionable opinion. The counter narrative that Ms. Hamilton provides is through affidavits of three other individuals about their impressions on Ms. Hamilton's character. And that really solidifies that these three issues are opinions. When evaluating whether a statement is opinion, courts look to the statement's precision, specificity, and verifiability. Neither of these are precise enough, specific enough, or verifiable enough for them reasonably to be construed as statements of fact. There's no measuring stick to gauge these statements. Mr. Tanik said something to the effect of professional standards. Perhaps if Ms. Hamilton were an attorney where there is rules of professional conduct, there would be standards to measure against. But there's no professional standards in the cat rescue community. That's just an opinion that Ms. Ozzie formed based upon things she observed. These statements belong in the marketplace of ideas and are worthy of protection under the First Amendment. My time is almost up, so unless Your Honors have any further questions for me, I would like to conclude that the district court did get its summary decision correct. This court should affirm on any ground supported by the record. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tanik, any rebuttal?
Judge Larkin mentioned that there was asked about a smoking gun. And I think there's more than a smoking gun here, with all due respect. I think there's a cannonball. The statements made by Ms. Ozzie that I gave verbal permission, I verbally surrendered him. I know I don't have a lot of ground to stand on here. I should have been clear. I formally surrendered him, and it was my mistake, and I'd like to visit him one last time. As I said, more than a cannonball, I think it's a smoking gun or a missile launched into this case that warrant a determination as a matter of law that there was an agreement, that the agreement was that Ms. Ozzie would transfer ownership of the cat to Ms. Hamilton, and therefore the trial court not only erred in granting summary judgment, but the summary judgment should have been granted for Ms. Hamilton based on that record. There's very scant, if any, evidence that to the contrary. The fact that Ms. Ozzie paid the first veterinary bill was because that was part of the agreement too. Ms. Hamilton said, well, I'll take your cat and I'll take ownership of the cat and subject to those conditions if you'll pay the first veterinary bill. And the reason for paying the first veterinary bill was to see if the cat was in enough condition to even warrant Ms. Hamilton taking him and if the cat could stay alive. And that's why they took him to the vet the first time, to just see what his condition was. And Ms. Ozzie agreed that she would pay the first veterinary bill. But in the record, as reflected in the record, Ms. Hamilton then paid more than $4,000, more than $4,000 of expenses for the cat. And as Judge Larkin correctly noted, it's implausible. It boggles the mind to conceive that someone would spend that kind of money for a cat that they don't own. And Ms. Hamilton does own these cats. They're part of her lifetime sanctuary. She takes care of them. She pays the expenses. And it's implausible that she would spend $4,000 on a cat that she doesn't even own, which is what happened here. So I think the record as a whole contains almost indisputable compelling evidence warranting a determination that Hamilton is the proper and correct owner of this cat, reversing summary judgment, and as I said, granting summary judgment for Hamilton. But as I said, in the alternative, there are at a minimum a disputed factual record that warrants overturning the summary judgment. As to the defamation claims, a couple of additional comments. The Anderson versus Kmart case, which I talked about before, a Supreme Court binding precedent. There, the term should not be trusted was deemed to be actionable. Here, the language is almost identical, cannot be trusted. The case law that we've cited time and time again indicates that accusations of dishonesty or lack of trustworthiness is actionable, again, subject to the jury making the ultimate determination. Accusation that Hamilton has, quote, stolen my cat, that's an accusation of theft. And even, as I said earlier, even if there was a dispute here, which we maintain there really isn't, but even if there was a dispute between a genuine dispute between the parties as to who owns the cat and what the nature of the transfer was, that would not equate to theft or stealing the cat, even if ultimately it were to be determined that Ossie was the proper owner, that would not equate with stealing a cat. It would because Hamilton had a claim of right, and there was, at best or worst, there would be a dispute over ownership, which doesn't equate to criminality. Put it this way: would any prosecutor consider prosecuting Hamilton for theft of a cat on this record? That accusation that she has committed, that she has stolen a cat, a crime, is definitely actionable, and it's actionable per se, as a matter of law. The state accusations about her lack of professional standards or professional competence and trying to encourage people not to patronize her are the kind of accusations that under the common law are deemed to be actionable per se because they question someone's professional reputation. And there was harm to the reputation here as reflected in the three supporting declarations by outside people who know Ms. Hamilton and are part of the CAT community. So we maintain that reversal is appropriate here, entry of summary judgment for Hamilton, or at a minimum, remanding the case, ordering the cat to be returned to her, and allowing the case to go forward on the defamation claim. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and the decision will be issued within 90 days.